Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. Appreciate that, even though it's a unusual, what we call weekend, unusual weekend, because it's after a national holiday. People are perhaps in different circumstances, but at least there's somebody out there listening, and others will perhaps jump on board as I continue speaking, and then others may listen to this later on. Somebody came to me with a notebook, you know, and I appreciated that he was interested enough to bring a notebook with him. You'd like to think what you have to say is worthwhile. But he had a broken pencil. I told him to write with a broken pencil is pointless. Now, the one groaning the loudest is Joan Leeson. She sent me a whole pile of those kinds of things, one-liner. But I won't necessarily always attribute, you know, to her which ones I use. I don't want her to necessarily be held accountable all the time, but I'll let her be held accountable for this one. So thanks a lot. Appreciate the input. So hello to the Leesons out west, and hello to the Drattlers out west. A wave to the Drattlers, and hello to the Harrises in the northeast. And if you heard a little bit of music, I hope that light brightened your day a bit. And then hello to the Minnesotans who listen, and out in Oregon, we have a listener who gives us a lot of appreciated feedback. And speaking of feedback, it's a rare man who can boast of the kind of son-in-law that I have, and I'll brag on him a little bit. You know, last week I mentioned that I had a book that was kind of out of date, a resource, and so now I have, he got me the new one, he surprised me with the new one today. So now I have the latest Handbook of Biblical Criticism, the latest one. So it's in terrific shape, it's reformatted, and you know, it's ready for the 21st century, so I really appreciate that. It's like, you know, I appreciate having these up-to-date resources. That's very important. You know, it's interesting, when it comes to the Bible, there was a kind of an effort to, there was a rather intense effort to discredit it at one time, but then with the discipline of archaeology, it tended to be corroborated more and more. So now there's, you know, a different perspective on the Bible than there used to be. It's much more respected as a historical source. The scholars reject the supernatural elements of it, but they have I think more respect than ever for the historical parts of it. And you're going to hear a lot of history today. Although this is not a talk on history, but history is going to be a factor in what I have to say today. Title of this talk is very simple. Know what to do and do it. You know, I think a lot about the fact that we have the Sabbath once a week. And sometimes I wonder about how much value it would be to people if they did keep that principle. In the state of Connecticut, they used to have a law that a business couldn't stay open 7 days a week, and they thought of it as a health measure. A person should have one day in seven to rest. A few weeks ago, and I don't want to, I'm not necessarily judging the man. I have no idea what his schedule is, but a prominent government official passed out, and I was thinking, I wonder if that man, you know, has a custom of taking one day in seven and resting. You know, maybe he does, and you know, it could very well be. But if he doesn't, I'd recommend it to him. Because evidently that's why he collapsed. It was simply exhaustion, as far as I understand. So it is important physically for the body to rejuvenate like that. But there's another reason, obviously, for the Sabbath. It's the fact that man is not just a physical being. You know, man is a being who can exercise character, or should be exercising character. He has the potential to be an ethical or an unethical being. You know, animals are operate on instinct. Human beings have an intellect, and they have a sense of right and wrong, and act accordingly. And we need that one day a week in seven to maintain our moral compass, to take a break and evaluate where our life is going, where it could be going, and to actually study what ought to be, to reflect on that. But if we simply reflect on it and don't respond, then obviously we've missed the boat and we're going to be in trouble, because you know somebody else could say he doesn't know any better. But in the case of people who actually take the time to keep the Sabbath and who even take the time to listen, to attend a service and listen, as some of you are doing right now or will be later, you know, if you're going to take the trouble to listen, then realize that not only are these words here, but these words are intended to affect a person and impress that person with what he should or shouldn't do, or how he or she ought to live his or her life. Now, one of the greatest satisfactions a teacher has is when to make a recommendation and people actually follow it, even in minor ways. I have never seen the movie 12 Angry Men. I've heard about it. I may have seen part of it. I think I might have seen a few minutes of it. Maybe I've seen the end of it, whatever. But there's a movie called 12 Angry Men. And one of the reasons I first heard about it is because I was in a school that was an all-male school. And they had some people that got involved in drama. And I guess when you're in an all-male school and you're a religious school, you know, there's certain limitations about what you can put on as a show, as a play. And I think one of the plays they put on was 12 Angry Men. Since that's the name of the play, I imagine you could do it and have, you wouldn't need a lot of women in the cast. If the focus is on this jury and they're all male, then the 12, you could go ahead and put the play on with all males. And evidently that's what they did. I didn't go to it, though, obviously, because, as I said, I've never seen the story all the way through that I know of. But I've heard of it as a classic movie, one of the great movies of all time and so on. So a couple of weeks ago, I had a student in my class who was a lawyer from Argentina, a young lady from Argentina who was a lawyer, and she's trying to perfect her English. And I said to her, you'll enjoy that movie. You ought to see it sometime. And well, a week later, she comes back and says to me, "Teacher, I saw the movie and I really enjoyed it." I'm thinking, wow, somebody actually followed my recommendation. It worked out, That's a real thrill. Well, obviously, God has these words here for a reason. He inspired people to give us these words for a reason. In fact, as people sacrificed everything so that we could have this material. The story itself of how the Bible was put together and preserved and translated is in itself a great story of heroism and, worthy of being told and retold. But we have the Bible now, and I want to cover one passage that is, I'm sure, very familiar to you, but it's in the book of James. As I said, the Bible is a guide so that from week to week we can crack it open and read it and then evaluate ourselves. And it's like looking in the mirror and to see if you have any blemishes, and then if you have them, you can wash them out. But that's the point, do we? I mean, we need to know what to do, but then we need to do it. Verse 22 of James 1. I'm breaking into the middle of a thought. He says, "But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was." So what good does it do you to look in the mirror if you're not going to do anything about it? If your hair is uncombed and you say, "Hey, my hair is uncombed," but then you don't comb it. "But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it and is not a forgetful hearer but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does." We have an ultimate blessing if we follow God's way of life, because it is a liberating way of life. Other ways of life, other alternatives really lead us to bondage, although they claim to be free, but they're not. They really are a way of bondage. It kind of reminds me of a nation now. There's a nation called, I think, the People's Democratic Republic of North Korea, but everybody knows that's not really how it's organized. It's one man rule. And so there are movements that claim to be liberal movements, free movements, this kind of lib and that kind of lib. And actually, what those movements do is enslave people. I'd like to go to Romans. And there again, we have the statement in the second chapter of Romans, verse 13. For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. There are a good many people who do go to church. One they go Saturday, they go Sunday, whenever they go. Especially in America, a lot of people do it. And they probably feel better for having done it and so on. But the point is, when they walk out the door, do they carry with them what they've been taught? Is it something they do to be seen? Is it something they do because it's maybe the right thing to do? Or is it a social thing, a political thing? Some politicians, I think, like to be seen going to church. Or do they do it for the sake of their wife or their husband or their children or for whatever reason? But at the same time, when they walk out of there, are they going to act on what they've heard? Now, the fact is that we have a heritage in this civilization. We have the so-called Judeo-Christian civilization that we live in. We do have a heritage. And so really, when it comes to Europeans and North Americans and South Americans, for that matter, we have centuries of instruction that we have received in terms of how to behave. Yeah, and then, of course, you could quibble with some of the technicalities, and rightly so. But nevertheless, we have a heritage of the Golden Rule and the Ten Commandments, and this is a part of what we have inherited and what is in our books and underlies a lot of our former education anyway. But the problem is that's the whole problem, or that's a major problem. It is our former education. We're deviating more and more from that. Less and less is that becoming the norm. Less and less are people can be people be counted upon to live that way even outwardly. In the past, at least people made a pretense of being that way. Maybe inwardly they were not that way, but at least on the surface, society had a certain stability and was going along according to that. But more and more, even outwardly, people are just flaunting it and ignoring it or attacking it, let alone what goes on, behind the scenes that we don't know about but often can suspect and sometimes do find out about, to our discomfiture. We find out what kind of things have been going on that we wish, had not been going on. Now, I want to go back to a period in history where we have the people of God, people who had a heritage, people who had the written word, had the Torah, had prophecy, had a relationship with God. He'd intervened for them over the centuries. He'd performed miracles for their ancestors. They had a relationship with him. And to show what happened when they simply ignored his instruction, he took the trouble to raise up prophets to bring to their attention what they were doing wrong, and they just chose to just go ahead and ignore what he had to tell them to their own hurt. There's an interesting period in the history of ancient Israel, particularly the southern kingdom of Judah, that I wanted to focus on today. This is the beginning of the ninth month on the sacred calendar. The new moon was yesterday, I believe. So this is the beginning of the ninth month on the sacred calendar. It's the second day of the ninth month. Sorry, the new moon was actually Friday. So today is actually the... the second day. This is Sabbath, yeah. So this is the second day of the ninth month. Actually, I was a little bit ahead of myself because I was going to move on and notice that that Monday or Sunday night would begin the fourth day of the month. Therefore, Sunday night the 21st begins Hanukkah. So the first night of Hanukkah is December 21st. So you can figure out how many shopping days are left. And I'm kidding, but... the Feast of Dedication is coming up, but the reason I mentioned the ninth month, one reason is because it's going to come up in the account I'm going to read about here. But I want to read about the history a little bit of ancient Judah. There was a righteous king. There was a king who did understand the importance of their heritage, who did understand the importance of their relationship with God, and who did want to lead the nation in a right way. Let's go to the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 14 and verse 34. Righteousness exalts a nation. When a nation is known as, as a nation that is orderly, that the government officials there are not corrupt, that it's safe to walk the streets of that nation. You know, that nation is going to be admired, respected. You know, you can go there and the streets are clean and the people aren't trying to, you know, the merchants aren't trying to rob you all the time and all the and so forth. You know, that's a place you want to go. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to a people. You know, a sinful nation is of course going to be internationally known as such. You don't want to go there. If you go there, you know, be careful. Be careful when you go there. And it's also wrong if internally we begin to fear one another and be suspicious of one another because of the way we're acting towards one another. If we become predatory towards our own fellow countrymen, that's just a shame. It's terrible. But this is what happens if people ignore just basic morality. And obviously, you know, that is happening more and more, unfortunately, in this society. And it happened in ancient Judah. But there was a righteous king, and under his reign, in the spring of 622 BC, Judah recommitted itself to the covenant that it had with God, the covenant that it made on Mount Sinai. During the Passover season of 622 BC, Judah reconfirmed that covenant under King Josiah. But unfortunately, King Josiah got involved in a war that he didn't need to get involved in. He died in that war prematurely. I say prematurely, he could have lived on much longer. So his reign was cut short because he died in that war. Well, the people of Judah realized that even though they were not, you know, not necessarily setting a good example, but they did have a very righteous king. But now without that king, they knew they were in trouble. A lot of them had a sense, uh-oh, God would probably protect us as long as that king is in charge, but now that he's not here, we're in real trouble. So let's pick up the account there in 2 Kings 24. 2 Kings 24, and talking about King Josiah. Verse 25. Now, this is 2 Kings 24, 25. Now, before him, there was no king like him, who turned to the Eternal with all his heart, with all his soul, and with all his might, according to the law of Moses, nor after him did any arise like him. Nevertheless, the Eternal did not turn from the fierceness of his great wrath with which his anger was aroused against Judah. This king was not enough to save the country. One king is not going to save the whole country if the country is misbehaving. And, of course, the misbehavior went back to an earlier king who ruled for quite some time and was very corrupt, a king by the name of Manasseh, and he's mentioned here, because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. So it goes back to the reign of Manasseh, and then from that point on, things never really got back to where they should have been. Although under Josiah, there was that recovery period, and that began a judgment of 40 years, frankly. 622 B.C. began a 40-year period of judgment upon Judah. And after those 40 years, by the way, Judah no longer even existed as a political entity on a map. It just disappeared from the geopolitical map by 582 B.C. Anyway, and the Eternal said, I will also remove Judah from my sight. That's what I just said. In other words, if you were looking at a map by 582, you wouldn't have seen Judah there. And the Eternal said, I will remove Judah from my sight as I have removed Israel, and I will cast off this city, Jerusalem, which I have chosen, and the house of which I said my name shall be there, even the temple. One reason the Jews had some confidence is that they thought, well, you know, we have the priests, we have the monarchy of David, we have the capital, Jerusalem, we have the temple. But, you know, those things don't mean anything if they're being abused, misused, corrupted. You know, God in a way would be better off without those institutions if they're not setting the right example. Now the rest of the acts of Josiah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? In his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went to the aid of the king of Assyria to the river Euphrates, and King Josiah went against him. Oh no, he tried to block the Egyptians from marching through his territory, but they weren't after him. They were just using his land to march through to fight the Assyrians, and he decided to oppose them. And Pharaoh Necho killed him at Megiddo when he confronted him. Megiddo, that famous battle area, you know, you've heard of Armageddon. So he died in the valley of Megiddo. Then his servants moved his body in a chariot from Megiddo, brought him to Jerusalem, and buried him in his own tomb. And the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, anointed him, and made him king in his father's place. So now we have a new king, Jehoahaz. Let's go now to the book of Chronicles. Second Chronicles. Now, Second Chronicles in your Bible comes right after Second Kings, so you kind of lose perspective. Second Chronicles is actually the last book of the Old Testament. It's kind of a summary of the history of the Old Testament. So in the Hebrew editions, it comes at the end of the Old Testament. And so here we have now this kind of summary book about the history of Israel and Judah. And looking at 2 Chronicles 35, and I want to go to verse 23. And the archer shot King Josiah, and the king said to his servants, "Take me away, for I am severely wounded." His servants therefore took him out of that chariot and put him in the second chariot that he had, and they brought him to Jerusalem. So he died and was buried in one of the tombs of his fathers. But all Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. And he was a great hero, even though many of them were not really doing the right thing, but they knew that he was doing the right thing, and they admired him, and they felt protected by him. They felt that God is going to bless us as long as he's king. Unfortunately, he decided to make that move and get involved in that war and lost his life. Now they're mourning for him. And in verse 25, Jeremiah also lamented for Josiah. And to this day, all the singing men and the singing women speak of Josiah in their lamentations. They made it a custom in Israel, and indeed they are written in the laments. So you see, before we had the destruction of Jerusalem, we already had the beginnings of the book of Lamentations. The book of Lamentations, as we know it, probably began as a prophecy of the doom and gloom that would come upon the nation because of their sins after the death of Josiah. It probably began as a prophetic book. And even though it's now a history book in a way, it's still unfortunately a prophetic book because the tribulation spoken of there will come upon the descendants of modern Israel unless they repent. The principle still remains the same. Now the rest of the acts of Josiah and his goodness according to what was written in the law of the Eternal and all his deeds from first to last, indeed they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. Now before we go further with the history, let's go to Lamentations. And here we see Jeremiah referring to Josiah and how sad his death was in terms of the history of the nation, because he was a righteous leader. Lamentations 4:20, talking about the Gentiles and how the king of Israel, king of Judah, died fighting the Gentiles. The breath of our nostrils, the anointed of the Eternal, you know, Mashiach, the Messiah of that time, the anointed, and he was, of course, an ancestor of Jesus Christ. The breath of our nostrils, the anointed of the Eternal, was caught in their pits, of whom we said, under his shadow we shall live among the nations. You know, we thought that under his protection we would survive, but now he's gone. And so we knew we were going to go from bad to, you know, into trouble, I guess in a way from bad to worse, because of the fact that they were not really behaving, and now that he wasn't there. You know, it's really too bad, because they as a nation did confirm their covenant with God in 622, but we're now in 609, so years have gone by, and they've begun to get lax again. Since he died in 609, that gave them a chance to, unfortunately, go back to their old ways of being, you know, stubborn and rebellious. So that being the case, Josiah has now died, and now we're in 2 Chronicles 36, and as I told you, Jehoahaz has become king. Then the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and made him king in his father's place in Jerusalem. But the nation now is going to be a weaker nation than before with the death of Josiah. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. So a very brief reign. Why? Well, now you're going to see. Now the king of Egypt deposed him at Jerusalem. Remember that Josiah had fought against Egypt, although they had not provoked him, except just by marching through his territory. But they, if you read the account, they had told him, we're not trying to pick a fight with you. But anyway, Josiah in effect picked a fight with them and lost. Now the king of Egypt deposed him, Jehoahaz, Josiah's son, deposed him at Jerusalem. And he imposed on the land a tribute of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. So now another son of Josiah becomes king, a brother of Jehoahaz, and he's put up as by the Egyptians. So now you have a kind of a satellite state, as the old Eastern European states were in the Cold War period. He's now a vassal of Egypt, in effect. Then the king of Egypt made Jehoahaz's brother Eliakim king over Judah and Jerusalem, and changed his name. I guess once a person vows loyalty to you, you know, then you to show that he's now your servant, you know, a king under your tutelage, his name is changed. So he gave him a name that was similar, but it was a new name, indicating now I'm in effect, a new person committed to my destiny, which is to be under Egypt. You know, so now his name was Jehoiakim instead of Eliakim. Instead of using the name El for God, we use now Yahweh. So now he is Jehoiakim. The Eternal will, you know, the Eternal sets up. And Necho took Jehoahaz, his brother, and his brother, and carried him off to Egypt. So now we have a former king of Israel actually as a captive in Egypt. Very sad. But his brother is at least still ruling. So you still have a descendant of David ruling. The brother of Jehoahaz is now ruling as Jehoiakim. Now you'd think he'd learn a lesson from this. Let's shape up here, you know, let's get our act together. We know how we're supposed to behave. Well, let's look to God to deliver us from this. But Jehoiakim just went right on as if, you know, none of this matters. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and he did evil in the sight of the Eternal, his God. It's so sad, you know, that after all this that has happened, Jehoiakim doesn't, who's a son of Josiah, he's had his father's example, but yet he didn't try to change his behavior or that of the nation. Now, there was a brief flirtation with trying to get rid of him, evidently. There was an attempt to overthrow him and put his son on the throne, his eight-year-old son. But evidently that coup only lasted 10 days, and it wasn't successful. And so he got back into power, and then that happened evidently after about a year of his power, and then he got back in power and reigned another 10 years after that. Let's go back to 2 Kings. Now, what I said just a moment, the last 30 seconds or a minute, or so are speculative, but they're based on the fact that the way the Bible put together the material, it's at least an interesting assumption. 2 Kings, we're in the 24th chapter. Look at the verse 8 of 2 Kings 24. Well, let's make a long story short, or let's say this. Jehoiakim was a very unrighteous king. And so let me just begin in the beginning of the 24th chapter. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. Remember, Jehoiakim had been a vassal of the Egyptians. Now Nebuchadnezzar conquers the country, and he becomes a vassal of Nebuchadnezzar. Around this time is when Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, you know, when they're taken captive. In the beginning of the book of Daniel is at this time. Anyway, so he's a vassal of the king of Babylon. Then he turned and rebelled against him. And the Eternal sent against him raiding bands of Chaldeans, bands of Syrians, bands of Moabites, and bands of the people of Ammon. So now Israel's being overrun with enemies, you know, on all sides. He sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of the Eternal, which he had spoken by his servants the prophets. I mean, it's not as if they didn't have warning. It's not as if they didn't know better. And unfortunately, that can be said of the United States and other Western nations. We have a heritage. We have moral codes that used to inform our judgments and our legislation. And if you go to our national institutions, you still see them there. As far as I know, in the Supreme Court building, the Decalogue is there, a picture, engraved, whatever. You know, it's so many of our governmental institutions, that heritage is there. Even on our currency, we still have on our currency, "In God We Trust," which I believe we put on during the Civil War. Surely at the commandment of the Eternal, this came upon Judah to remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he had done. And of course, other rulers unfortunately followed suit overall, other than Josiah. And also because of the innocent blood that he had shed, for he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which the Eternal would not pardon. You know, God is not going to look favorably on a society that allows people lives to be taken without dealing with it. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Jehoiakim rested with his fathers. He finally died after this 11-year reign, and the country obviously was worse off than ever. Then Jehoiakim, his son, reigned in his palace. So now we have a grandson of Josiah, Jehoiakim. The Eternal will establish. That's the Eternal establishes Jehoiakim, or Jehoiakim. Then Jehoiakim, his son, reigned in his place. And the king of Egypt did not come out of his land anymore. See, now the Babylonians are powerful. For the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt, from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates, all the way from the Sinai Peninsula to what is today Iraq. The Egyptians were now losing out. Babylon was on the rise, the Chaldean Empire, the Neo-Babylonian Empire of the Chaldeans. Jehoiakim was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. His mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. So you see here that when he became king after the death of his father, he was 18 years old. Now let's go back to Chronicles, and you'll see something a little different, and that's what I'm trying to say. That evidently there was a brief period when he was 8, when people tried to depose his father and have maybe a regency with the son as king in name, but you'd have a regent ruling until he gets old enough to rule, and the regent would be attempting to run the country, and then hopefully when the son got old enough, either get rid of him or find a way to influence him where things could still be done the way they wanted them done. But anyway, let's go and notice this. Jehoiakim, I'm now in 2 Chronicles 36 and verse 5. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and he did evil in the sight of the Eternal, his God. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against him and bound him in bronze fetters to carry him to Babylon. So he actually took him prisoner, but he never got to Babylon, as we'll see. But he did take him prisoner, which is a terrible thing for the king of your country to be taken prisoner like that. And he was going to take him to Iraq, but he didn't finally get there, as we'll see in a moment. Nebuchadnezzar also carried off some of the articles from the house of the Eternal to Babylon and put them in his temple at Babylon. Verse 8. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim, the abominations which he did and what was found against him, indeed they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. Then Jehoiakim, his son, reigned in his place. Jehoiakim was 8 years old when he became king. So evidently, now that we're at the end of the Old Testament period, we want to summarize the whole history, so we have this additional information that 10 years earlier he had had a brief reign of 10 days, which I think was possibly because somebody wanted to push his father out of the way and have this 8-year-old as a ruler with a regency behind him. You see what I'm saying? Sometimes that kind of thing is done. So he was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months and 10 days. What are those 10 days? I think those 10 days are when he was 8. And then when he was 18, he ruled for the 3 months, as you saw earlier. So that's why I think the Bible put that information together that way, to give us a hint of that. But unfortunately, whatever you say about him, about his career, he finally, when he was 18, he took over full control of the country, and he ruled for 3 months, and what? And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal. So he was not a good king, and a lot of bad things were said about him too, which I won't have time to get into today, because I want to get into something else. But let me just notice here. Let's just notice this in verse 10. At the turn of the year, King Nebuchadnezzar summoned him and took him to Babylon. So his father had been taken prisoner but never brought there. And I'll show you why in a minute. But he was brought there. Here's the king of Judah, who is now transported to Babylon as a captive, with the costly articles from the house of the Eternal, and made Zedekiah, Jehoiakim's brother, king over Judah and Jerusalem. And if you go back to the account in 2 Kings 24, it's his uncle. I'm trying to save time here, so I won't go back to 2 Kings 24, but it's his uncle. So now Jehoiakim's brother, Zedekiah, becomes king. So Jehoahaz had been king, he'd been deposed, and his brother had become king, and now another brother becomes king, Zedekiah. So three sons of... three sons of Josiah have that chance to rule, because this is Zedekiah, and he was the brother of Jehoiakim, who had been the son of Josiah, right? No, I'm sorry. They were grandsons. I apologize for that. Jehoahaz had been the son. No, I'm sorry. I'm right the first time. Because they were brothers of Jehoahaz, right? Okay. So these are sons of Josiah, and he's the uncle of the ruler who had been deposed. He was the brother of the ruler's father. And he made him king over Judah and Jerusalem. So here we have one king who goes to Egypt in captivity. Another king is taken captive and, as we'll see, dies. Then another king is taken to Babylon and is a captive. You'd think by now the country would finally say, hey, we need to do something about this. This is terrible. This is humiliating. We really need to change. But nothing happens. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal, his God, and did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Eternal. He had a man of Jeremiah's stature right there, preaching to him, warning him, and he didn't respond. Now let's go see what Jeremiah did to his brother, Jehoiakim. Jeremiah 37. Here is, we're going backtracking a bit to the time of Jehoiakim. Did I say Jeremiah 36? I hope I said that. Anyway, Jeremiah, the 36th chapter, here we are. Now it came to pass in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that this word came to Jeremiah from the Eternal, saying, take a scroll of a book, and write on it all the words that I have spoken to you against Israel, against Judah, and against all the nations from the day I spoke to you, from the days of Josiah even to this day. So collect this material. You've been in the ministry for quite a bit of time now. Collect the material. And he had a scribe named Baruch. You know, the Arabic version of that is Barak. But this was Baruch, because he was speaking Hebrew. It may be that the house of Judah will hear all the adversities which I propose to bring upon them, and everyone may turn from his evil way, that I may forgive their iniquity and their sin. Then Jeremiah called Baruch, you know, the scribe, the son of Neriah, and Baruch wrote on a scroll of a book, at the instruction of Jeremiah, all the words which he had spoken to him. And Jeremiah commanded Baruch, saying, I am confined, I cannot go into the house of the Eternal. You know, he was already marginalized. You know the old saying, if you don't like the message, kill the messenger. You go, therefore, and read from the scroll which you have written at my instruction, the words of the Eternal, in the hearing of the people, in the Eternal's house, on the day of fasting. And you shall also read them in the hearing of all Judah who come from their cities. Now, whenever a country is having a decline, there's going to be those who fortunately don't go along. There are those who maintain the standard. And in those days, there were no doubt people who were devout people, who were, you know, people who wanted to maintain a standard. And they were going to have a fast. And it was in this month. This is the ninth month now that I'm reading to you, in which I'm reading to you. This is the second day of the ninth month, and that fast was declared for the ninth month back then, which is a cold, you know, in ancient Israel, it was a cool, wet time. It's the cool season, the rainy season, you know, late fall, early winter in the land of Israel. It may be that they will present their supplication before the Eternal, and everyone will turn from his evil way. For great is the anger and the fury that the Eternal has pronounced against this people. And Baruch the son of Neriah did according to all that Jeremiah the prophet commanded him, reading from the book the words of the Eternal in the Eternal's house. Now it came to pass in the fifth year of Jehoiakim the son of Josiah, king of Judah, in the ninth month, this month of Kislev that we're in now, that they proclaimed the fast. Now who's going to be fasting? I presume, you know, the ones who really cared, the more spiritual members of the community. I doubt the majority of people fasted, but at least some fasted. And they proclaimed a fast before the Eternal to all the people in Jerusalem and to all the people who came from the cities of Judah to Jerusalem. So obviously they wanted everybody to do it, but I suspect a lot didn't. But fortunately some did. Then Baruch read from the book of the words of Jeremiah in the house of the Eternal, in the chamber of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan the scribe, in the upper court at the entry of the new gate of the Eternal's house, in the hearing of all the people. When Micaiah, the son of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, heard all the words of the Eternal from the book, he then went down to the king's house. So these words were very moving. They were very powerful. They were the words of Jeremiah that God inspired, and they were read, and they had an impact on the servant of the king. So it says, he then went down to the king's house, into the scribe's chamber, and there all the princes were sitting. Just to save time, I won't read there all their names. I'll just go to verse 13. Then Micaiah declared to them all the words that he had heard when Baruch read the book in the hearing of the people. Therefore all the princes sent Jehudi, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Shelemiah, the son of Cushi, to Baruch, saying, take in your hand the scroll from which you have read in the hearing of the people, and come. So Baruch, son of Neriah, the son of Neriah, took the scroll in his hand and came to them. And they said to him, sit down now and read it in our hearing. So Baruch read it in their hearing. So the word's getting out there. You know, it's going to the people that need to hear, the VIPs. Now it happened, when they heard all the words, that they looked in fear from one to another and said to Baruch, we will surely tell the king of all these words. So now they're going to go to the king, Jehoiakim. And remember, he wasn't such a hot king, as we know. And they asked Baruch, saying, tell us now, how did you write all these words at his instruction? So Baruch answered them, he proclaimed with his mouth all these words to me, and I wrote them with ink in the book. In other words, it was Jeremiah's words, but I just copied them. Then the princes said to Baruch, go and hide, you and Jeremiah, and let no one know where you are. Because we don't know how the king is going to be affected, you know. Rulers don't like to be criticized. But it's worth a try. So we're going to try to, you know, get this information to him. But you better, be careful. As we say in colloquial language, lay low. And they went to the king into the court, but they stored the scroll in the chamber of Elishama the scribe, and told all the words in the hearing of the king. So the king sent Yehudi to bring the scroll, and he took it from Elishama the scribe's chamber, and Yehudi read it in the hearing of the king, and in the hearing of all the princes who stood beside the king. You know, he wanted to hear to have the exact words read. After he heard this account, he said, you know, go get the scroll and read it. Because he could have said, I don't want to hear anymore, enough, and that way at least the scroll would have been saved. But no, he wanted them to take the scroll and read it to him, word for word. Now you'd think that this means he's responding. But look at what happens. Now the king was sitting in the winter house in the ninth month. Remember, as I said, it's late November, early December. So it's cool and wet in that part of the world. Now the king was sitting in the winter house in the ninth month with a fire burning on the hearth before him. And it happened when, it could have been even later in December, we don't know when in the month this was. And it happened when Yehudi had read three or four columns that the king cut it with the scribe's knife and cast it into the fire that was on the hearth until all the scroll was consumed in the fire that was on the hearth. Could you imagine this? All his advisors had been so moved by these words, and they went to him, and they gave him an account, but saving the scroll. And he said, I want the scroll. Come, bring it. Read it word for word. And then what does he do? He cuts it up and throws it in a fire. Throws it in the fireplace. Could you imagine? And the princes, of course, went along with it. You know, yuck, yuck, yuck. You know, it's like these people that go around saying, you know, if there is a God, let him strike me. You know, let that thunderbolt come and take me away. And if it doesn't happen, they think they've proved something. You know, my God's all worried about their opinion of him or something, that he has to perform some miracle. You know, anyway. Yet they were not afraid, nor did they tear their garments. You know, they didn't act like people do when they're mourning. They should have been terrified at what was being read, but they didn't care. The king nor any of his servants who heard all these words. Nevertheless, Elnathan, Deliah, and Gemariah implored the king not to burn the scroll, but he would not listen to them. So even some of his own advisors said, don't do this thing. But he did. And the king commanded Yerachmiel, the king's son, Sariah, the son of Azrael, Shelemiah, the son of Abdael, to seize Baruch the scribe and Jeremiah the prophet. But the Lord hid them. So yes, he would have gone after them. It's terrible to think of that. But God did intervene in this case and protect them. And after a while, of course, kings can cool off, or they can realize, hey, this might not be the most politically expedient thing to do. They do have some following, and after a while it gets to be a little safer. But at least for that moment, his anger was intense enough, he'd have gotten at them and maybe would have killed them both. But God protected them at that time. Now, after the king had burned the scroll with the words which Baruch had written at the instruction of Jeremiah, the word of the Eternal came to Jeremiah, saying, take yet another scroll, and write on it all the former words that were in the first scroll, which Jehoiakim the king of Judah has burned. And you shall say to Jehoiakim, king of Judah, thus says the Eternal, you have burned the scroll, saying, why have you written it in it that the king of Babylon will certainly come and destroy this land and cause man and beast to cease from here? Well, why did he write it? Because it's what was going to happen. That's why he wrote it. Therefore, thus says the Eternal concerning Jehoiakim, king of Judah, he shall have no one to sit on the throne of David, and his dead body shall be cast out to the heat of the day and the frost of the night. You know, as you see, his son only reigned for 3 months. That ended that. Just 3 months, not even a full year. I will punish him, all his family and his servants, for their iniquity. And I will bring on them, on the inhabitants of Jerusalem and on the men of Judah, all the doom that I have pronounced against them, but they did not heed. Now, the words were preserved anyway. He burned them up, but they were recopied. Not only as a witness against that nation, but so that we could have the book of Jeremiah here. As also a witness against us if we don't obey. Then Jeremiah took another scroll and gave it to Baruch the scribe, the son of Neriah, who wrote on it, at the instruction of Jeremiah, all the words of the books which Jehoiakim, king of Judah, had burned in the fire. And besides, there were added to them many similar words. So even more was written. And we have the book of Jeremiah today and the book of Lamentations. Now let's just go briefly to Jeremiah 22. I'm not going to read a lot of that chapter. That's why I said briefly. I'm going to go to this 22nd chapter of Jeremiah and just notice that Jehoiakim might have been prepared to be taken prisoner to Babylon, but evidently didn't get there. So maybe once he was shackled, there was some attempt to deliver him out, to escape or whatever, and he died in the attempt. They killed him before they ever brought him to Babylon. Verse 18. Well, I'll go back just to verse 16. To verse 15. All right, let's go to 15. Because this way we compare Josiah with Jehoiakim. Josiah had been a righteous king. Jehoiakim, his son, did not follow the example of his father. Shall you reign because you enclose yourself in a cedar? Did your father eat and drink and do justice and righteousness? Did not your father eat and drink and do justice and righteousness? You know, your father lived as a king, but he also was a righteous king. Then it was well with him. He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well. See, governments are there to protect people who can be exploited and taken advantage of. I mean, who else are they going to turn to? That's one reason why we have a government, is to protect the vulnerable. Was not this knowing me, says the Eternal? You know, if you love God, you'll love your fellow human beings, right? Because you don't see God now. We he's not manifest the way he will be someday, but other people are around that we can see. Yet your eyes and your heart are for nothing but your covetousness, for shedding innocent blood, for practicing oppression and violence. Therefore, thus says the Eternal concerning Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. They shall not lament for him, saying, alas, my brother, or alas, my sister. So people aren't going to worry about you when you die, even though you're the king. There's not going to be a great mourning for you. And evidently, his queen was taken away, and whenever she died, no big deal was made about her either. They shall not lament for him, saying, alas, master, or alas, his glory. He shall be buried with the burial of a donkey, dragged and cast out beyond the gates of Jerusalem. That's what you get. Not a royal burial, but just, you know, you die in captivity and you're buried along the way. You know, the Babylonians have no use for you. And, that's what you get, even though you've been a king. You get this humiliating death. Very sad. I'd like to go forward now to 2 Chronicles and summarize where we are here. In 2 Chronicles, as we tell the story as the Old Testament concludes, in 2 Chronicles, we're in the 36th chapter. Jehoiakim, of course, was an evil king, and we saw what happened to him. Zedekiah, his brother, took over, because Jeconiah only ruled for 3 months, as I said. He was said that his descendants wouldn't rule. So evidently, a 3-month period was allowed, but that was it. Zedekiah was 21 years old in verse 11 when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal, his God, and did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Eternal. And he also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear an oath by God, but he stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Eternal God of Israel. So he had made an oath to Nebuchadnezzar, but he broke it and rebelled. Moreover, all the leaders of the priests and the people transgressed more and more, according to all the abominations of the nations, and defiled the house of the Eternal which he had consecrated in Jerusalem. The very leaders, the very spiritual leaders, were corrupt. The ones who should have been teaching people how to behave were actually encouraging misbehavior. Now that's happening now in our society too. How many people that are clerics are encouraging negative behavior? It's very, very, it's very sad. And the Eternal God of their fathers sent warnings to them by his messengers, rising up early and sending them, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of God, despised his words, and scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of the Eternal arose against his people, till there was no remedy. So the words were there, the words were given, they were given in a powerful way. You know, God's people were very dedicated, the prophets got up early in the morning to do their job, and the people just ignored it. Therefore he brought against them the king of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, on the aged or the weak. He gave them all into his hand. And all the articles from the house of God, great and small, the treasures of the house of the Eternal, and the treasures of the king and of all his leaders, all these he took to Babylon. So none of these institutions could protect them because of their sins, because they had abused and misused and corrupted these institutions. Verse 19, then they burned the house of God, broke down the wall of Jerusalem, burned all its palaces with fire, and destroyed all its precious possessions. And those who escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, where they became servants to him and his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia. And so for a 70-year period there was captivity upon Judah, and the bulk of them were not in their land, they were in exile. Verse 21, to fulfill the word of the Eternal by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. The people had been given a system of economy, and they had been given a moral law, and they had been given economic law, and they had rejected this package, you know, this treasure. They had rejected it. And so they weren't keeping the sabbatical year. You know, the nation wasn't observing that. And so for 70 years, they weren't farming the land, so the land got to catch up on all the Sabbaths that it had missed, you know. To fulfill the word of the Eternal by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. As long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. And so finally, we had, of course, after 70 years, God in his mercy renewed his covenant with his people, brought them back from captivity. But there was that 70-year exile. I'd like to turn to Leviticus 26. The focus in the Old Testament seemed to be on the first four of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are in a way divided into four and six, although the fifth one is like a transition between the two. You have the duties of man of human beings towards God, the first four, and then the duties of human beings toward their fellow human beings, which is the last six. The fifth commandment is honor your father and your mother, which kind of goes either way, since God really is our father. And so, you know, we honor God, but at the same time, you know, we're supposed to honor our human parents. So we have the first four commandments and the last six. And if you go to Leviticus 26, the focus there seems to be on the first four, the duties of humans towards God. Verse 20 of Leviticus 26, you shall not make idols for yourselves, nor a carved image, nor a sacred pillar shall you rear up for yourselves, nor shall you set up an engraved stone in your land to bow down to it. For I am the Eternal, your God. So let's avoid idolatry. Let's not pervert God's religion. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Eternal. So you see, the focus here is on man towards God. But man towards man is also very important in the Bible, as I've already shown you. The king of Israel was supposed to protect the vulnerable. You know, we have the responsibilities of man towards God and man towards fellow man. Now, when Christ came on the scene, And he talked about his generation, which was another generation of destruction of the temple and captivity and exile. You know, the condemnation there was more for the last six commandments than the first four. I'd like to go to Matthew 23. before the destruction of the second temple. This was the destruction of the first temple that I just read about. But before the destruction of the second temple, Christ focused on the last six commandments, humans towards other humans. You know, maybe you're technically keeping the Sabbath, and maybe you're not, you know, making idols, but how are you treating each other? Matthew 23:23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin. You're so particular with these technicalities, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. Now, if you have justice, mercy, and faith, you're going to treat your fellow human beings in a different way. And these ought you to have done without leaving the other undone. It's not that the other's undone. It's not that you neglect the technical side and you just focus on one. You can do the technical. Yeah, you should do it. But you have to focus on your fellow human beings because they are the weightier matters. The weightier matters of the law are justice, mercy, and faith. Your attitude and how you interact with people and your very inner being is more important than technical observance of the tithing laws, even though they're part of the system. So Christ condemned them for that, for particularly being negligent in the last six of the ten. And now if we go to Matthew 23 and verse 37, he summarizes the whole history of that people and how they did not properly respond all through the history of the Old Covenant, unfortunately. So you had the Babylonian captivity, and now you have the Roman captivity. You know, and really the Babylonian captivity never fully ended, nor has the second captivity ever fully ended. You know, the exile, in effect, still lingers on to this day. Matthew 23, verse 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Which is, of course, Psalm 118, verse 26, you know, that part of the Hallel. And so someday Israel will greet the returning Christ with those words. Now, it's interesting, when Christ came to Jerusalem as a carpenter and rabbi in his human ministry, they were saying that to him when he entered Jerusalem. But they quickly turned on him when he was arrested. And he didn't miraculously deliver himself or deliver the Jews from the Romans. They quickly turned on him, felt that he was a false prophet, and wanted him to die. You know, so they had greeted him that way at first, but then they turned on him. And particularly the leadership, of course, was trying to do him in, conspiring with the Roman government to do him in. So what he tells here, particularly the leaders, he says, someday you are going to greet me properly. You know, and I'm not going to be back here until you do. So the time is coming when Christ is going to return, and he is going to be greeted by the leadership of those people and then by the masses of those people as the coming Messiah and the coming Lord. You know, and they will say to him when he returns, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Eternal. At that time, there will be that reconciliation between the Jews and their Savior and their Messiah. But these are not just intended for one nation. They're intended for us to understand, you know, that when we have instruction, we need to look into it and learn from it and see what's there. And then we need to do it. We need to respond. We need to know what to do and to do it. You know, and so it's nice to pay our respects to it, but we also need to make sure we know what's there and then that we're doing it, that we really are responding to it. And so at times we will be made uncomfortable as a result. Services should be encouraging and inspiring and even entertaining, but sometimes services are going to make us uncomfortable because we're going to come across things that are flaws that we have that we're going to have to overcome. You know, as it says in the book of Hebrews, in the fourth chapter, Hebrews 4, it says, for the word of God, and this is verse 12, Hebrews 4, for the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and marrow, and a discerner of the thoughts and intent of the heart. So it is very powerful if we have a conscience, you know, to listen to God's word from week to week, or from hopefully from day to day, and to respond to it. It can make us uncomfortable at times, but that's all part of life. You know, knowing that we have problems, have to overcome, is part of living. So let's conclude then by going to the book of John, the 13th chapter, John 13. I was recently sent an email, and really appreciated receiving it. And one of the questions in the email, or the question in the email, had to do with the Passover, I guess the chronology of the Passover. And I believe I have sermons on that you can download, and I'll do it. I'll talk about it again. I talk about it every year, but I'm going to talk about the Passover now, in the sense that Christ, when he did the foot washing, told them that he was instructing them on how to behave. It was for them to look into the instruction, but also to do the instruction, to follow through. So I'm in John 13, the very famous passage about the foot washing that we read each year at the New Testament Passover service. And in John 13, in verse 17, after explaining to them about the foot washing, Jesus says, John 13:17, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. So that's really what it comes down to. One of the important reasons why we have the weekly Sabbath is to bring us back into that reality, the spiritual reality. We need to know what to do and to do it. And if you know these things, so first of all, we need to know. And then secondly, blessed are you if you do them. That's my word for today. Know what to do and do it. Thanks again to those of you who listen to this, and those of you who will take the trouble to listen to it later on. We hope that you enjoy the rest of the Sabbath, and that if you have to travel back to some location, that your travel is safe. And our thoughts and prayers go out to those who've recently been the victims of terror. That's a very sobering event that took place in India that I'm sure you're aware of. So our thoughts and prayers go out to those affected by that. And for those of you who are hearing this message, enjoy the rest of the Sabbath and the week ahead. All the best to you and yours.